We are cautiously encouraged by these developments. The situation on the Korean Peninsula is a complicated problem, which will take time to resolve.
Southeast Asian leaders call for North Korea to abandon its nuclear program. It's Monday, March 19th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, power consolidates in China, a call to ban alcohol in part of Australia, color in the streets of India, a free health clinic, cleaning up space junk. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Southeast Asian leaders and Australia's Prime Minister Sunday called on North Korea to end its nuclear program and urged United Nations countries to fully implement sanctions. We hear more from VOA Asia's Ira Melman.
Leaders at the first summit of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, known as ASEAN, issued a joint statement with host nation Australia.
We've affirmed our joint commitment to respond strongly and resolutely in the face of the grave concerns we share about North Korea's reckless and illegal nuclear missile programs.
Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull. The joint statement urged North Korea to immediately and fully comply with its obligations under all relevant United Nations Security Council resolutions and called on all countries to implement the sanctions. Singapore's Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong, the current chair of ASEAN, said the bloc had been encouraged by negotiations for the spring summit and had noted recent developments.
On the Korean Peninsula, we have noted reports of North Korea's commitment to denuclearization and its pledge to refrain from further nuclear and missile tests during this period. And we've also noted the recently announced plans for President Donald Trump and the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un to meet in the near future. We are cautiously encouraged by these developments. The situation on the Korean Peninsula is a complicated problem which will take time to resolve. And we hope these recent steps will contribute towards lasting peace and stability.
U.S. President Donald Trump and South Korean President Moon Jae-in, who are both planning to meet North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un this spring, last week pledged to maintain maximum pressure on his authoritarian regime and seek action on giving up his nuclear weapons. Ira Melman, VOA Asia.
Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull said Sunday that the bloc had also discussed the humanitarian disaster with Myanmar's Muslim Rohingyas. He said Myanmar's leader Aung San Suu Kyi has reached out to the group for help. Australia, which is not a member of ASEAN but is seeking closer ties with the group, hosted the regional meeting in Sydney. The ASEAN nations are Brunei, Cambodia, Indonesia, Laos, Malaysia, Myanmar, and the Philippines, along with Singapore, Thailand, and Vietnam. We invite you to read more on our top story by following us on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. These are among some of the top Asia stories currently trending on voanews.com. South Korea says North Korean and former U.S. diplomats to meet in Finland. Sri Lankan president lifts state of emergency. Wildfires sweep across Southeast Australia. Polio vaccination team members killed in Pakistan. U.S. investigates deaths in Hyundai Kia cars when airbags failed. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. We also invite you to stop by the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. China's top legislative body, the National People's Congress, has been gathering for its annual meeting in Beijing. After it voted to remove presidential term limits last week, the nearly 3,000 delegates heard a set of proposals that will overhaul the structure of the Chinese central government, also known as the State Council and led by Premier Li Keqiang. Among the biggest changes are the consolidation of national banking and insurance regulators, the establishment of an environmental super ministry, and a supervisory commission that will oversee disciplinary matters of all public sector employees. VOA Asia intern Harry Chen spoke with Dr. Ming Xia, professor of political science at the City University of New York, who has researched Chinese leadership and political development. He explained implications of this reshuffle.
First, let's talk about environment, because environment used to be an independent bureau, but because the environment issue had become a big issue, especially under Xi Jinping, this had become the source of dissent or protests. So for Xi Jinping and his legitimacy depends on people's satisfaction with his work over the environment. And so this is how the environment had been consolidated and put into some other ministries. And in terms of banking and insurance, because Chinese government is facing major potential financial crisis, because the Chinese Communist Party created a new committee to prevent financial crisis.
So how successful do you think this super ministry have been, and what about the chances of further consolidation of these ministries?
When we talk about super ministries, I think we have different tracks. One track, I can say it was proposed more by Li Keqiang and from the angle of the State Council. So Li Keqiang wanted to consolidate the ministries into bigger ones. So I think that would is easier for him to supervise all the ministries and the functions to coordinate the work of the State Council. But I think there is another development that is more from Xi Jinping, because Xi Jinping has proposed a lot of super national committees, like the National Security Committee and also the National Supervision Committee. So all these committees, they are above the State Council. So I think, and we have to keep in mind, even Li Keqiang wants to consolidate the ministries within the State Council, but actually a lot of functions have been taken away by the national committees, which are above the State Council. In Xi Jinping's idea, he has created more committees. So Xi Jinping is trying to govern by committees, but with the marginalized role for Li Keqiang, no matter what Li Keqiang is trying to do, and his super ministries cannot be very powerful in comparison to the newly created super commissions under auspices of Xi Jinping.
Some people say that consolidating government agencies into super ministries can breed more abuse of power and corruption, because few officials would have even more power because they were incorporating all the other ministries' responsibilities. Do you think that's true?
I think no matter you have petty bureaucrats or more powerful bureaucrats, I think their behavior is not going to be changed by merger or by centralization, because if you don't have the accountability, so it means the government officials, if they are more responsible to the officials above them or to top leaders, but they don't have a democratic accountability or responsiveness to ordinary people, because really ordinary people, they have no mechanisms to control the government officials or to hold them accountable. So this is why I think no matter what the Chinese government reshuffle for their ministries, I think it's not going to change the fundamental relationship between the ruled and the ruling classes.
Dr. Ming Xia, professor of political science at the City University of New York, speaking via Skype with VOA Asia intern Harry Chen. China's ceremonial legislature voted Sunday to approve Li Keqiang's appointment as the country's secondary leader of the ruling Communist Party. The largely rubber-stamped National People's Congress voted 2,964-2 to approve Li's appointment for a second five-year term as Chinese premier, who traditionally serves as the country's top economic official. President Xi Jinping, however, has stripped the post of most of its prominent duties by appointing himself to lead party bodies that oversee economic reform and state industry. The approval of Li's appointment comes a day after Xi was reappointed as Chinese president, this time with no limits on how many terms he can serve. Happening now in Asia, the Afghan Taliban say they are deeply skeptical that a proposed three-nation conference in Indonesia will be a step toward peace. Jakarta is preparing to host a trilateral conference where religious scholars from Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Indonesia would seek ways to bring peace to war-torn Afghanistan. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad you're spending part of your Monday with us today on VOA Asia. Doctors are urging that alcohol be banned in the troubled central Australian town of Tennant Creek for 5 years. The Northern Territory government has imposed 2 weeks of emergency alcohol restrictions in the town following a sharp increase in alcohol-fueled violence. But as Phil Mercer reports from Sydney, medical professionals believe stricter measures are needed.
Demands for sweeping changes to alcohol laws in the northern Australian town of Tennant Creek followed the alleged rape of a 2-year-old Aboriginal girl and a series of suicides. Doctors discussed at a public meeting how they treat an endless stream of pregnant women who are drunk and other Aboriginal people who've been attacked or attempted suicide while intoxicated. They also treat children with fetal alcohol syndrome, a condition that can cause mental and physical birth defects and is brought about by excessive alcohol consumption by an expectant mother. Tennant Creek has a population of about 3,000 people. About half are Indigenous Australians, and they have high rates of unemployment, ill health and overcrowded housing, while the community is also blighted by alcohol abuse and domestic violence. Nationally, Australia's original inhabitants make up about 3% of the population, yet they are disproportionately represented in crime figures. Authorities in northern Australia say a recent 2-week period in which alcohol sales were restricted has made Tennant Creek safer. During that time, limits were placed on the hours alcohol could be sold, as well as the amount of beer, wine and spirits that could be purchased. The mayor of Tennant Creek, Steve Edgington, says opinion is divided in the local community.
The local police are telling me that the restrictions have been very effective. The 3 hours per day has certainly reduced the supply and the consumption of alcohol. There's other members that think that the restrictions should be even wider. Some people are saying that being able to purchase one carton of beer a day is still too much and they'd like to see further restrictions in place. So, look, I'm hearing different opinions from different parts of the community.
Doctors warn, however, that a long-term solution to reduce alcohol-fuelled violence is needed. The medical professionals insist that a 5-year ban on alcohol in the town 1,000 kilometres south of Darwin would help its residents to recover. Alcohol is banned in dozens of Aboriginal communities, usually with the full support of tribal leaders. Smuggling alcohol into these so-called dry areas can attract large fines. For the 2-week period, alcohol was restricted for the entire population of Tennant Creek. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
News is mobile and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
News from VOA Asia, China's ceremonial legislator voted Sunday to approve Li Keqiang's appointment as the country's secondary leader of the ruling Communist Party. The largely rubber-stamped National People's Congress voting overwhelmingly to approve Li's appointment for a second 5-year term. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features to see and share. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. 4 years after street art arrived in India, colorful murals are transforming urban landscapes in major cities such as Mumbai and New Delhi in a variety of places, from slums to rail stations. The appeal is not just visual. Anjana Pasricha tells us these outdoor paintings are helping to brighten the environment of rundown urban spaces and putting the common man in touch with art as it frees it from the confines of galleries.
These birds at a metro station in New Delhi symbolize freedom and hope and send a message to passers-by, fly high. A nondescript residential neighborhood in the Indian capital has turned into a public art district after artists plastered its walls with larger-than-life paintings. Street art is picking up momentum, says Julia Ambrogi, whose foundation is at the forefront of the movement.
So there are like many more initiatives which are like starting up in small villages, in like smaller towns. And then at the same time, we see many artists which perhaps earlier they would have never thought about a wall as a canvas, that instead are like really interested in exploring this new medium.
Perhaps the most dramatic transformation has taken place in a Mumbai slum, where the vibrant coat of colours has prompted comparisons with Italy's picturesque Positano village. The Mumbai-based not-for-profit Chal Rangde or Let Us Colour initiated the project to change the slum's drab environment. The paintings by artists and volunteers reflect the life of slum dwellers, an auto rickshaw which many men drive, a pet kitten, inspirational messages for the young. City resident Deepia Reddy, who led the project, says street art alters perspectives.
And we feel like adding a dash of colour does a lot of change. Then you would just think that, you know, oh, it's just colour. It's not. Because it gives you a sense of hope. It gives you a sense of, this thing that everything's going to be all right.
Attitudes are changing. Proud residents keep the slum clean and don't let people spit or vandalise. And the neighbourhood's vibe has changed, says resident Pushpa Raj Shetty.
If the place is dull, life seems dull. People don't even recognise each other. If it is colourful, people have a different smile on their face.
For those living in urban sprawls that are becoming more crowded and rundown, street art is a breath of fresh air. Like for New Delhi resident Sonia Vij, who has joined a walk to appreciate the murals.
I think it's a great way to like discover new things about your city and just kind of stay in love with Delhi, which becomes hard as time goes by.
Along with Indian artists, several international artists have been involved in projects by the START Foundation. Ambroji, who comes from Italy, says the effort is to transcend national boundaries.
Melting pots is what make our countries great. So that's what we are trying actually to open up. Like, so really mixing and blending like different influences from everywhere.
For the time being, this splash of colour is giving some public spaces a makeover. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
This news from VOA Asia: Southeast Asian leaders and the Australian Prime Minister want North Korea to end its nuclear program. The leaders said in a joint statement Sunday they have grave concerns about Pyongyang's nuclear and missile programs. Singapore's Prime Minister says they're cautiously encouraged. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, with the rising cost of healthcare in the United States and the growing demand for services by those who can least afford them, two doctors in Clarkston, Georgia, made a commitment to do something about it. Founded 5 years ago, the nonprofit Clarkston Community Health Center wanted to make a difference by providing free treatments and services for lower-income residents in the city of Clarkston and its surrounding communities. Since then, the clinic has expanded its services to provide free laboratory diagnostics and prescription medicines for refugees. Sela Damgur from VOA's Kurdish service visited the clinic and has this report.
At this clinic in Georgia, doctors volunteer around the clock to help patients who have no medical insurance. Pharmacist Saeed Rais, president and co-founder of the clinic, points to a tremendous need in the community.
The refugees who are coming here, they are provided refugee aid for about 8 months, and after they're on their own. A lot of them, and you can see, they can't even speak English, and then you expect them to go get a job and have health insurance through their job or be able to purchase their own. It's almost impossible. We see about 70 to 75 patients every Sunday in 4 hours.
Doctors Rais and Gulshan Harji, who have a combined total of 35 years in medicine, came up with the idea for a free clinic in 2013.
It took us almost a year to put the bylaws, to put the paperwork together, to get our 501c, to put a board together. And then it took us another almost a year to find this space that would be conducive to our work.
Many of their clients speak English poorly or not at all, so the clinic always has translators on hand.
So we have staff who speak several languages. Like, for example, Dr. Harji herself speaks 6 languages. I can handle 3 or 4. And then we have other staff, and then you saw we have some interpreters that were provided by Emory medical students who train them, the Burmese and Rohingya, and then we have Arabic interpreters. And on top of that, we have access via phone.
In addition to basic care, the clinic also provides preventive health care and low-cost prescriptions.
We offer, mammogram, we offer other, tests and immunizations, and we also provide free medications to people who have, and if we have that medication, otherwise we refer them to the pharmacy where they can get low-cost medications.
For many patients, the clinic serves as an essential safety net.
Insurance is so high right now, and a lot of people can't afford insurance. We need more places like this.
I have children, but we are facing financial difficulties. I am sick, my husband is old, sick, not able to work, and we need to pay our apartment rent. The center helps us a lot, and doctors here are very kind and friendly.
Besides getting their most urgent medical needs addressed, patients say the clinic is also a place for moral support. A caring oasis that helps lower-income people overcome some of the daily hardships they face. Saleh Demijer, VOA, Clarkson, Georgia.
Space scientists say the satellites and other spacecraft orbiting the Earth, including the International Space Station, are in increasing danger of collision with pieces of junk. Engineers are working hard to solve the problem of removing the trash that threatens functioning satellites worth millions of dollars. We soar with VOA's George Pudich as he floats details to us.
The problem of space junk can be solved in two ways, says Luisa Innocenti, head of the European Space Agency's Clean Space Office.
The problem of the space debris has to be fixed in two ways. First one, we need to stop polluting. And second way, we have to remove the garbage, if you want, the debris.
Both methods are hard to implement. There is no international treaty for minimizing space debris, although individual nations have rules for deorbiting dysfunctional equipment or removing it to the so-called graveyard orbit. In the meantime, the amount of junk keeps growing because occasional collisions create additional smaller pieces that cannot be controlled or captured. ESA scientist Jesus Gil Fernandez says the agency is experimenting with a robotic arm that could capture larger pieces and move them to safer areas.
We use the camera, which is mounted on the smaller robot arm, to mimic, to reproduce the motion of the satellite around the target satellite that we want to deorbit, to capture.
Italian scientist Michele Lavagna says old satellites could be captured with special nets.
So the concept is to, to mimic what the fishermen do on the sea, and so to have a very large net to stay away from our debris and med satellites that is stumbling and moving freely, and then from that distance to keep our net, and you just try to wrap all over your satellites.
Others, like ESA's Benoit Bonvoisin, study the possibility of building satellites that could be less hazardous and lower the pollution of both space and Earth.
Right now, we're trying to understand what happens to the materials we use, and then we'll see how we can improve them, how we can work on the design and conception of the satellite, how the different parts of the satellite break up in relation to each other, in order to have a satellite which is safer at the end of its life and creates the smallest amount of debris on Earth.
But for now, there are no dates set for the first real-life space junk pickup. George Pudich, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find our program online at iTunes and SoundCloud. We, of course, stream each and every day on VOA Asia Facebook and our website, voanews.com. We'd love to hear from you. Reach out to us via Facebook, or you can send us an email, voaasia@voanews.com. We might even read your email on the air. Let us know what's going on in your part of the world. A lot of listeners find us on the radio. Wherever you happen to be in Asia, tune in to many great radio stations like Falcon Radio at Adamson University in the Philippines. We thank everyone there who tuned in today. We always thank our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer Zainab Abdel-Rahman for keeping us on the air, managing editor Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and David Byrd on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a nice day ahead.